Everybody wants to be famous. I understand that completely, because I did. Being on air is cures everything, except, obviously, you know, serious terminal diseases. I never, ever once got the train home without believing that I was going to be fired the next day.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which you hear from those who made a difference. Tommy Boyd.
I was born in West London in December 1952, and my mum told me just once, some years later, that I was delivered on a mattress in a corridor in a hospital, and that she was alone when it happened. But because she was a wartime child, they don't talk about things. And what I found out many years later is that the 3 days before I was born in London was the worst man-made ecological disaster of all time, in which 4,000 people died through inhaling a sulfuric smog.
Special filtering bunny masks are the latest weapons devised to combat smog, which last winter killed 4,000.
In the days and months after that, some 30 or 40,000 people died. So, piecing that together, I was born on the floor in a corridor. My mum said it was touch and go because there was nobody to help. The hospital was full of people who were dying. And that didn't affect me in any way because I didn't know anything about it. Except when I discovered all that, I was reminded that my mum and dad's generation were not good communicators. They tended to think that any show of fear or grief was unpatriotic, I think. But then, when I was seven, something happened to me that did change my life, and I was aware of, which was my younger sister died, and she'd been ill for about 2 years. My parents just went to pieces. My mum in particular was just distraught, and I never saw either of them laugh again. That is the effect that the loss of a child can have on you. What effect it had on me, I don't know, because my parents tried to sort of pretend it didn't happen and didn't talk to me about it. When I was 14, I overheard a conversation between my mum and one of her relatives, in which my mum was explaining that they'd found a neurological condition in my father's family, which had killed two of his siblings quite young, and that there was a 50% chance that he would develop it, and a good chance that it's what killed my sister, in which case there was a 50% chance that I would develop it, and if I did, I'd have about 18 months to 2 years. So from the age of 14 until I was about 20, 21, I was saddled with this possibility that I could die quite soon. I don't know what effect it had on me, but it did make me realise, in the words of Jim Morrison, that no one gets out of this one alive.
5 to 1, baby, 1 in 5. No one here gets out alive now.
So I decided to get on with my life. And one day my mum said to me whilst we were watching Blue Peter, she said, "You could do that." And that's all it took. So I decided, OK, I'm going to do Blue Peter. So I settled down and aimed for that.
Well, we'll be back again on Thursday and we'll be having some new bicycles in the studio.
See you on Thursday then. Bye-bye.
There wasn't much television around at the time, not much radio either. And so anybody and anything that was on television was massive. And there was this character called John Noakes who presented Blue Peter, who was a human being. There were plenty of presenters who acted like presenters, but John was very canny, I think, at coming across as being gauche, full of mistakes. Years later, when I met him, when I was doing the ITV equivalent, Magpie, he gave me a tip. He said, "Do you remember that time when I went to get the cake out of the oven and I couldn't find oven gloves?" He said, "You know why I couldn't find the oven gloves?" I said, "No, go on." He said, "Because I'd hidden them." He said, "Because I knew that what people liked was when it goes wrong." So when I realised I wanted to do Blue Peter or Magpie, I looked at the job and I saw teacher, journalist, entertainer. So I aimed to get those three things under my belt. I went straight from school to a shop in Staines where I worked, a Debenhams, where I worked in the toy department at Christmas. And then they found various other jobs for me until I went to America to work in New York with homeless kids, looking to set up a drama theatre for them. And they offered me a green card and said would I stay, but I knew what I wanted to do, so I came back, went to teacher training college in Brighton, discovered that Brighton was one of the cities that had its own local radio station, and they didn't have enough students working on the student programme. So I walked in, knocked on the door, and they said, "Yes, come in." and I was producing the programme within a couple of weeks. You can't do that now.
This is BBC Radio Brighton.
Radio Brighton was a small organisation and it had a very small transmission area. My favourite programme on it was a 10-minute programme on a Wednesday for blind listeners or people who were visually impaired. The presenter said, "And we have a news item. There is a cracked paving stone outside Woolworths in Western Road." And I thought, that's local radio. That's it in a nutshell. What did I learn at Radio Brighton? I learned how to make a ewer work, how to edit quarter-inch tape, how to write scripts, how to write trailers, how to perform trailers. I also learned that radio stations thrive on factions. I discovered that there was a faction. The newsroom hated the programmes. Everyone hated sport and sport hated everyone. The managing editor hated everyone and everyone hated him. You had to locate yourself in each of these various factions. And I think in all the radio I've done, I've always been quick to spot the factions. And I think that's one of the skills that nobody talks about is politics within any radio station, in the industry generally. They had a programme at Radio Brighton which was called Contact, which was a 20-minute once a week programme for and about the student population of Brighton, which was quite high, and it was very dull. And I didn't improve any of that because I didn't know enough. You don't go in and start saying, "I think we should be a bit more jazzy, a bit more studenty. Why don't we play the latest Beatles record? It's funky." I kept a low profile, but at the same time, I was picking up tricks, watching things and going, I would do that if I was ever a producer or a presenter. I wouldn't do that if I was ever a journalist or an entertainer.
Hello, BBC Radio Brighton. Can I help you? Yes, Mrs. Holmwood, yes.
I made very good friends with the man who was the overseer of the student programme, a man called Chris Warbis, who later became Christine Warbis, and was a tremendous broadcaster, a really warm, caring individual. And when I left college, I looked at Radio Brighton and thought, is there a job here? And there weren't any jobs. So a friend of mine called Paul Hollingdale, who was the first voice on Radio 2.
Hi there, Paul Hollingdale here, and this is what we'd like to say.
Wake up easy, start the day right.
He had a business working in broadcasting PR. And he said to me in his inimitable voice, "Well, there's a film star in London who nobody wants to interview. And the PR people have said to me, help. And they're paying me to send people to interview him. There's no outlet for it. I can't pay you. But if you can sell it, you can keep the money." So I did the interview and I took it to LBC. I said, "Could I speak to the arts producer?" And 5 minutes later, a dapper, lovely man came up with a rich broadcasting voice. And he said, "Are you the young man who wants to see the arts producer?" And I said, "Yes, I am." And he took me into his office and he asked me what my background was in radio. And then after 5 minutes, he said to me, "We've just let the arts producer go. Would you like his job?" So within 24 hours of leaving full-time education, I had a job with an office and a title on the door. And I was LBC's arts producer. They'd been running about 6 months. And they were firing all the people who they'd hired on big salaries. So I did that job for about 3 weeks. And then they were short in the newsroom, did some producing, gave me an ulcer, literally. I got an ulcer. In the newsroom, everybody smoked 80 a day. Some people brought in bottles of whiskey and vodka and just put them on these big round console desks that producers all worked around. And if you were having a good day, you would bum somebody's silk cut. Bad day, you would nick somebody's gourwar. I produced with a guy called Mike Lewis, who went on to be head of Radio 5, who was a really kind mentor. And when you're going from never having done any journalism to doing serious journalism, covering, you know, Northern Ireland and the Middle East, and I needed a lot of help, and he gave me that help. And we used to have to write suggested questions for the presenters. I began to learn how to approach radio from a journalistic perspective as opposed to the magazine perspective, which was the backbone of Radio Brighton. But it wasn't working in that the audience wasn't big enough, and therefore the revenue wasn't big enough. We only had two advertisers on LBC for about the first 18 months, I think. Freddie Barrett's Liquor Mart and the Houndsditch Warehouse. Houndsditch Warehouse went, the Houndsditch.
The Houndsditch Warehouse. There's hundreds of ways everybody can save at our store.
And I'd look at the engineer and the engineer would look at me and we'd go, oh, jeez. But the other one was for a Liquor Mart owned by a guy called Freddie Barrett, and he did his own ads. And it ended with, come to Barrett's.
Barrett's.
Barrett's Liquor Mart.
Barrett's.
Yeah. A, it drives you nuts. B, you're aware that your employer is not making enough money. So we were frightened for our future. We knew that LBC was being supported by the revenue coming into IRN, which was a sister company based on the same newsroom. And they were selling 3-minute news bulletins 24 hours a day to every single commercial station in the country. That income was guaranteed to increase because every time a news station was commissioned, IRN would get more revenue. And the IRN people, journalists, who were pucker journalists, looked down on us, who were a bunch of misfit students like me, for a variety of reasons, including they knew that it was their endeavour that was paying our salaries. Hard-nosed journalists are combative. I saw fights. I saw people have hot coffee thrown over them because of disagreements about the validity of one news story or another. It was never personal. It was always about the news. I had two goes on air at LBC. They wanted to try me out as a phone-in presenter, so they gave me a 15-minute phone-in programme in the afternoon. And I was hopeless because I was too young. And, you know, in American talk radio, they say you can't do that job until you're about 50.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about that. You're going down Definitely this morning, are you?
Yes, I'll be there from about 10:30 onwards, I should think.
Well, I was there yesterday, and I'm sure you'll get a bigger crowd than I did, but we got a huge crowd, and the only thing to worry about is your right hand, because you do get cramp signing all those autographs to Ray.
It's all right, I'm used to it, actually, Dougie.
Oh, are you?
The other job they gave me was travel. And I had a 3-week stint at Scotland Yard standing in for Therese Birch. So I had to rent a room in Kilburn because I had to be at Scotland Yard at 5 a.m. and I couldn't do that coming up from Brighton where I lived. And a funny thing happened to me, which is that I used to go around the corner to a little Irish caff in the evening and have liver and bacon. And I was sitting in there on my own one evening, apart from 4 people sat around a table not far from me. And I listened to their conversation. 3 men and a woman. And I heard in a soft Irish accent, £2. And then I also heard Gold is Green. And then I also heard 2 a.m. Anyway, I woke up at 4 o'clock in the morning in my rented room, turned on the radio, just to check if anything had happened overnight, and a £2 bomb had gone off in a pillar box in Gold is Green at 2 a.m. And at work, I'm at Scotland Yard, and I've got a big copper sat to my right and a big copper sat to my left. And I'm thinking to myself, should I tell them what I heard in that caff? And I did something that I regret. I went, nah, I must have made that up. That can't have really happened. And it's just one of those things in life where you go back and you wonder either why you did something you shouldn't have done or why you didn't do something you should have done. There were also occasions when a story came my way and I had to get the scoop on it.
The Pan Am co-pilot looks out of the window and is horrified by what he sees.
I remember one night I was just leaving to go home, having put together a breakfast programme. It was 8 o'clock in the evening, and the old ticker tape machine clattered, and there'd been a plane crash in, I think, Tenerife in the Canary Islands. So I phoned our air expert, and he said, yes, he'd be happy to come to the phone at 7 o'clock and 8 o'clock and 9 o'clock. But me, I had to fill a 4-hour programme. So I took my coat off and sat down. There was no actuality. There were no reporters in Tenerife. I had nothing to play, just LBC's air expert who would talk to Bob and Doug, the presenters, for 3 to 5 minutes. I had the rest of the hour to fill. So speaking a bit of Spanish, I started ringing hotels in the area of the airport on the off chance that somebody might have seen something. I was put through to a guy who turned out to be the editor of Norway's number one newspaper, who was on holiday in Tenerife, and he'd seen it. He'd been standing in the passenger lounge of the airport, and he'd watched the two planes collide on the runway and burst into flames, and he'd seen the carnage. So I did three-minute packages with him in a booth, and I recorded the three interviews with this guy who was very emotional about what he'd seen. He'd seen people on fire. And I went to bed that night feeling I'd more than done my job. I think it did go out on the satellite, and I think quite a few stations around the world played it. But, this is the thing. At 10 o'clock the following morning, when the show went off the air, I got a phone call from the person who'd put the show out, the studio director. And I thought, this is it. I'm going to get a medal. And you know what he said to me? He said, why didn't you edit out the gasps? And I said, because this is a man who has just seen hundreds of people incinerated in front of his very eyes, and he's reliving it in the telling of the story, and the emotion is just pouring off him, and that's how it should be. And he said, well, I think you're just lazy, and don't do it again.
This is LBC on 261. Pass it on.
I was producing the breakfast show on LBC, and it was going quite well, and then I went to a party and found out from somebody who was at the party that one of the presenters of Magpie, ITV equivalent of Blue Peter, was going to leave in about 3 or 4 months, but it wasn't going to be announced. So that night I went home, and on my portable typewriter I typed a side and three quarters letter to the producer introducing myself and saying that I was a journalist, I was an entertainer, I was a teacher, and I'd be, you know, damn obvious for the job. I was 24 when I did that. And again, I had a bit of luck, which was that the producer of the programme received my letter and also happened to be a listener to the programme that I was producing. And he wanted to meet me anyway to talk about it. And so he made me the first person on the list to get an audition. The audition was a 20-minute audition. You had to do a piece to camera about yourself. Then you had to interview a child, a girl who had been hired from a stage school, whose job was to be a difficult interviewee. It must have been fun. Her job was to be monosyllabic. If she was asked a yes-no question, just to say yes and no. And then I had to make a recipe. I had to make a pancake. I didn't want to appear perfect, so I sort of botched the pancake thing slightly. Instead of tasting the pancake by myself, the little girl who I'd interviewed 5 minutes before was still sitting on her stool on the other side of the studio. And quite spontaneously, I just went, come over here, Claire. I said, taste that, see what you think of it. And she went, mmm. And I went, all right, it's me that's auditioning, not you. And I saw some camera people suppressing little laughs, and I thought, this is going quite well. Anyway, I wound up as the floor manager was doing the wind-up signal, and I knew to say, I look forward to seeing you next time. And they played the theme music, and it finished, and I got a round of applause from the crew. And I assumed that was normal. Later in television, when I understood what a cynical bunch they are, I realised what an accolade it was that they put their hands together for the audition. And so then I had a horrible 6-week wait for the phone to ring, or maybe not. But it did ring, and I got asked to lunch with the head of children's, and I was being on my best behaviour. And then, just before the first course arrived, she went, oh, I better put you out of your misery, you've got the job. Now do you want a fag? I went, not half. And where's that wine? Well, Magpie was a theft. And the extremely wonderful and intellectual man called Lewis Rudd, who devised it, an Oxbridge scholar and the youngest ever contestant on the Brain of Britain BBC radio programme at 14, he knew that there was so much right about the Blue Peter format that you didn't need to change anything. So it was two boys and a girl, 3.5 items per show, going out twice a week for around about half an hour. That was the Blue Peter format, and it was simply lifted. And we were a doppelganger of Blue Peter, with one or two slight differences. We were more like down the youth club drinking Coke, and Blue Peter was more dressed in your Scouts and Girl Guides uniform before you go off to the hut, drinking milk and muffins, eating muffins. We had more pop music than they did, and we had some good acts. I think we gave Kate Bush her first television performance. That was my idea. I was driving home from a nightclub at 2 o'clock in the morning, and I heard Wuthering Heights on Capital, and I thought, oh, well, that's got to make good television, and so it did.
Out on the windy, windy moors, we'd roll and fall in green.
So we played a bit more pop music than Blue Peter. We were a bit more relaxed than Blue Peter. We sometimes didn't rehearse things at all, and the cameras would have to follow us around. And I think that produced a different, and for me, better atmosphere, and also made it just such a pleasure to do.
I hated you, I loved you too.
Everybody wants to be famous, and I understand that completely, because I did. Partly because I didn't think I was going to be alive for very much longer, and I wanted to leave my mark. When you suddenly discover that you can't walk down the high street without 90% of the heads turning, when you can't walk into a pub without it going quiet, when waiters are suddenly extremely polite and helpful towards you, it's quite a heady drug. And I totally understand why a lot of people don't quite make it work for them. But I came to be uncomfortable about it quite quickly. And I used to have a mate who I trained as a teacher with, and we used to go out for a beer on Tuesdays and Thursdays and sometimes Fridays and Saturdays. And after a while, he said to me, I can't do this anymore. He said, because wherever we go, you get surrounded by people wanting not just your autograph, but to talk to you and take something away from the experience of having talked to somebody who's on television. And so I got dropped by a mate, you know, literally my best man, when I got married. He said, I can't stand it. And there were always things about it that were enjoyable, but increasingly being known wasn't much fun. But I was in a particular category. I was never a celebrity, and I never have been. I'm just a piece of furniture. Everyone knows me, but I was never going to do Saturday evening television. For whatever reason, I don't have any star quality. I don't know why that is. Perhaps it's because I feel a little bit guilty about being paid quite a lot of money for doing something that actually I enjoy so much. When I got the Magpie job, I guess you'd say I was cute. The hair was a problem because I didn't have a hairstyle. And so the makeup department took me to the King's Road and gave me a haircut. And I looked a bit like a comic character, which not many people remember, called Dan Dare. It was a blonde quiff, but my girlfriend, as a present, bought me a perm, and I went to a hairdresser's in Brighton and came out looking like a cross between Leo Sayer and the other Magpie presenter, Mick Robertson, who had naturally frizzy hair. And Mick is an extremely nice, generous guy, and also one of the most talented broadcasters the country's ever had. And he never said a word to me about it. But I know he felt it.
Hello, welcome to Tom and Jenny, who are looking very smart. I think you'll agree, no problem.
Well,
very good.
Yes, this actually has something to do with the Empire Rollerdrome, New York, and we'll tell you what that is later on.
We might also tell you something about racquetball, which is a new American sport that's come over this country.
And in complete contrast, a smashing traditional British recipe. But first...
Magpie was taken off the air because it was expensive. The summer holiday films that we used to make, going to exotic places like Peru, the budget for that, there was no way we were recouping that in advertising. And we found out that actually it was Benny Hill who was paying for Magpie. And that didn't sit well with the accountants, so they killed it. And I got a phone call almost straight away from LBC saying, OK, well, you're famous now, so we'll let you broadcast. And we're just getting rid of a Sunday night presenter, a man called Jeremy Beadle. And we'd like you to take his slot on. And it has to be quirky and non-news, because it's a Sunday night. So it took me about 6 weeks to deal with people ringing up on air and saying, get off, we want Jeremy Beadle back, which is what always happens. And Beadle was quite an act to follow.
A good evening and welcome to Nightline, Sunday, October the 26th.
Sounded like that. And I got a phone call from the Royal Variety Club saying, would I be willing to attend the Royal Variety Club Showbiz Awards of the Year And I said, well, yes, thank you very much indeed. And the voice at the other end said, well, that's just as well, because you're not allowed to tell anybody what I'm about to tell you, which is that you've been voted the Independent Radio Personality of the Year. And I was cock-a-hoop. And I couldn't understand it, because I'd only been doing the job for 3 months. And so I decided that it was probably, I'd probably got the award because I wasn't Jeremy Beadle, who ruffled a lot of feathers.
Perhaps, Redhead and Timpson, you'd learn a bit from that how to dress for breakfast radio.
After that, LBC offered me the Saturday morning children's programme, so I was back doing children's things. I was doing a programme called Jellybone for Children on a Saturday morning.
This is Jellybone.
And a late night programme on a Sunday night, which had a big audience of 16 to 24s. So again, I was gravitating back towards children's. And I took an idea to ITV, which was that children like news, but not the way it's packaged. So why don't we turn it into some kind of a quiz format? And they liked that. And so they took it on, and I wrote and presented a programme called What's Happening, which featured commercial radio stations going head-to-head. So you had four young listeners from Radio Air in Leeds versus four young listeners from a radio station, Bristol or whatever. It was okay. We got about 48 to 52% of the share at the time, which meant that every year you were biting your nails as to whether it would be renewed. But then what happened was that the same television company, Central, canned Tiswas, and they were looking for a follow-up programme. And they did some research and they found out that the Children of Britain's number one hero was a wrestler called Big Daddy. So they approached him and asked him if they could build a show around him on a Saturday morning. They did some dry runs, some pilots, and he wasn't very good. And he knew he wasn't very good. It got to 10 days before the show's launch when he disappeared. And so the producers and the head of children's were in the bar that evening wondering what the heck to do, because they were on the air in 10 days. And I was over the other side of the bar having a drink, and one of them said, what about that little oik over there? And I got the job. And I did 2 seasons of that, and then I did 2 seasons of the Saturday Starship. All because I was in the bar at the time when they were tearing their hair out wondering who. And this is me being lucky all the time. And then I went on and did the Wide Awake Club.
OK, well, listen, make a date. Join us next Saturday at 7:30. We've got tons of the usual stuff. And, of course, next week sees the return of number 73. Have a smashing week. See you next Saturday. Bye-bye.
Bye!
In between, I started to filter back into radio because two friends of mine who were journalists at IRN won the licence for a radio station in Brighton, commercial station, called Southern Sound. That was a fantastic, huge journalist called Keith Belcher and Rory McLeod. And because I lived 400 yards from the station, they asked me to recreate the Sunday night show that I had on LBC, and I started doing that and loved it. That again ran for 2 years. The audience was huge. People still remember it to this day because we did quirky things. We presented the show from the within the liver of one of the zoo members. We were doing wacky things with sound effects and suggesting that we were on the planet Jupiter. It wasn't Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy or anything, but we tried.
Okay, have we got all the carts fired and oiled?
Take the news bed out.
And standing
please.
By, the news bed's out, standing by. Okay, have we got all our bits of paper?
We haven't got the opening theme. We've got the weather. Right. Oh, do you want to read the weather?
The weather, no.
I stayed in children's television until 1995, doing bits of radio. And I was working for the Children's Channel when it was announced that we were going to get a national commercial talk station. And I thought that would be fun. Well, it turned out that the man who I'd suggested to be programme controller of Southern Sound and who owed me a favour, Jeremy Scott, was going to be the programme controller of Talk Radio. So the phone went and it was Jeremy. And he drove down and I was the first signing for Talk Radio.
Starting from Tuesday the 14th of February, Talk Radio UK commences its service of frank and explicit chitter-chatter, entertainment and other unpleasantness.
The idea of talking to members of the public on the air, having been a Butlin's Redcoat, that was meat and drink. But the station was one-third owned by an American chain and they wanted a talk station. So they flew, three of us would-be presenters, me, a guy called Moz D and a guy called Scott Chisholm to Los Angeles to show us talk radio in action. Moz had only ever been a disc jockey on a Coventry commercial station, and Scott was a television journalist. And Scott wasn't going to change what he did, and he was right not to, because he was good. And Moz didn't really know his way around radio, but I'd done enough talk radio to understand what I was seeing, and I was mesmerised by what they did and how they did it. Lots of people in broadcasting, sadly, think that talk radio is about being a shock jock and saying something horrendous. But when you see it being put together, and the creative talent and the commercial drive and the ambition, I wanted to bring that home and do the British version of it. But I only ever met resistance because there was a fear that all I was going to do was say, hello, good evening and bollocks. And there's so much more to it than that. What allowed them to do it in America was Ronald Reagan relaxing the fair play rules about radio. American radio used to have to balance. Well, Reagan did away with that. And radio stations discovered that there was a huge audience that wanted to hear right-wing views. And we don't have the license to do that in this country. And some broadcasters are still to this day discovering that if you don't balance your views, then Ofcom will come down on you like a ton of bricks. So I think we could do a type of talk radio in this country better than the Americans, but it would have to be non-political.
Call Talk Radio UK on 0345 10 53 89.
You always felt as though you were standing on a trapdoor at talk radio. Everybody did. We had, I think, we had 13 programme controllers, programme directors, in about the first 2-3 years that we were up and running. Basically, one programme director only altered the furniture. The output at Talk Radio was, it turned out, an attempt to recreate Radio 5, or 5 Live as it had become. Had a decent audience. And if they could get that sort of audience, then they would start to generate money. So Talk Radio looked to imitate Radio 5. That wasn't going to work because we didn't have the resource. The BBC have got such resource. Not only people, 14 and 15 producers on every show, whereas Talk Radio had one, but cross-promotion, which when he arrived at Talk Radio, Kelvin McKenzie was quite right. The station is never going to be able to compete with the BBC because we can't get TV promos. We can't get Radio 4 mentioning us. We can't get Radio 1 promoting us. So he came up with the idea of turning it into a sports station. And he was right. I mean, that was a genius move. You either like or hate Kelvin McKenzie. Almost everybody hates him, but I do both. I think the bloke's fantastic and a genius, but at the same time, I can't stand him.
I'm not.
You were.
No, look, I'm not.
You are.
I'm not.
I'm not getting into this. Yes, I am. No, I'm not. But...
Well, don't start it then. Because I've said to you about 6 times that I have not changed my tack, and all you have done is come back and said, yes, you have. Well, I haven't.
Talk Radio tried a lot of different formats with me. The first one was a bog standard. You interview guests about kind of interesting things. Then I had a new producer who said, let's talk about in the afternoon the news stories that nobody has yet talked about. Nobody had talked about them because they weren't very interesting. So we got no phone calls and I had no guests. So sometimes I would talk for 2 hours. But then the station recruited a little guy called Peter G, a Scots guy, to do all the trailers. And he has a tremendous sense of mischief and anarchy about him. And he would come in and he would say, oh, Tommy, why don't you talk about something like this? Why don't we give all the homeless people a free dog, because the dogs' homes are full of dogs that need a home, and homeless people all need someone to snuggle up to. I would say, you can't say that, Peter. Go, oh, you can. You can in the right way. So what we did was we took the American talk format, which is where you do a monologue, and then you take dissent. So it's called monologue debate, but it's monologue dissent. So I would do an 8-minute monologue suggesting something utterly stupid, ridiculous. Oh, I've just bought myself a jet ski. Aren't they fantastic? Knowing that everybody hates jet skis. Another one I said was that Elvis Presley was a fantastic actor. It's a shame he couldn't sing. Completely impossible to argue. For example, I said dry cleaning doesn't exist. They wash your shirt in a washing machine. dry it, iron it, and then spray it with essence of pear drops. Wrap it in plastic and charge you £4. And that nearly got into trouble with the dry cleaning industry, except the radio authorities, it then was, wrote back to them and said it was clear that the person was engaging in comedy, not broadcast journalism. I would like to put on record one thing that we did, which was so good that it's now illegal, which was, because I was aware that an awful lot of people were listening to the show just to catch me out, their modus was they wanted to get me fired. So I did a monologue that lasted for about 8 minutes about the fact that the German economy and the lifestyle of Germans improved between 1933 and the middle of the 1930s. Then what I did, in the middle of a sentence, I stopped talking. And we played a little bit of audio that sounded like hiss or white noise. And then a pre-recorded announcement said, "We apologise for the break in transmission. Normal service will be resumed as soon as possible." And then there was silence. And I did this for about 2 to 3 minutes, which is quite brave. And then I came back with a call that I'd recorded myself. So it was me pretending to be an old listener who was incensed. So I was saying, using telephone quality, "I cannot believe what you have just broadcast. To me, it is the most vile, appalling and disgusting series of views that I have ever... And I shall be writing not only to your employer, but to the radio authority and..." And I said, "Well, you're entitled to your views." And I went to a commercial break. When we came back from the commercial break, I said, "I have to apologise. Apparently, one of our transmitters went down. We have 13 transmitters. 12 transmitters heard what I said. But apparently, 1/13 of our audience did not." And I carried on, because the switchboard was full of people who claimed that they'd heard what I'd said and wanted to get me fired. So I had a succession of callers complaining about something that they hadn't heard. But the implication was that what I'd said that other people had heard on transmitters that were working was vile. It was a personal exercise for me to prove that there are people who are even prepared to lie, not just distort in their own minds what they think they've heard, but lie about what they might have heard in order to get the person on the radio. It's like the poppy syndrome. For the 3 weeks prior to Armistice Day, if a presenter is not wearing a poppy in the proper way, they will be utterly crucified and vilified. And it's the same sort of mentality. We've got to get him. We've got to get him. And so the opprobrium grew and grew and grew. And as I was leaving the building, there was a phone call through to reception. And it was from a person who claimed to be the editor of the Jewish Times, saying, "How could I justify what I said?" And I said to him something that I'd said to other listeners. "Did you hear what was said?" And he said, "Oh, yes." He said, "Well, I wouldn't repeat it. I wouldn't say it out loud." So complaints... An unimaginable amount of complaints went to the radio authority. Our compliance officer said to me, "I've listened to it," he said, "and it was brilliant. There was one line in your monologue that I'm uncomfortable about, where you said that there was something very striking in a good way about the uniforms that some of Hitler's people wore." That's something that Brian Ferry has got into trouble for saying, I believe, just more recently. And I could see his point. It was really important that in my monologue, I was very historically accurate and fair and balanced and journalistic about the journey that the German people had from their own perspective through the 30s. But that didn't stop some people hoping, really hoping, that I'd said something that was going to get me fired. And the radio authority came back and said, "You did not say anything that was in any way illegal or unacceptable or should not have been broadcast. That said, we are making moves to make sure that nobody is ever allowed to pull a stunt like this again." And I can see why they wanted to do that. But I can also say that I was pleased that I did what I did on that occasion for my own reasons, and so that I could use that in future occasions when I said something that the bosses would say, "You shouldn't have said that. We've got lots of complaints." I could say, "Yeah. But those are people who are simply out to get me. They are not people who are taking a balanced view about what I'm broadcasting. They are the people who used to be hunter-gatherers who don't have anything to hunt anymore."
"Your programme is absolutely rubbish."
"Yes, I know. What can I do?
absolutely rubbish tonight.
I know, it's appalling. What can I do?
Get somebody else to broadcast.
We need some better callers as well.
Yes, that's another thing. That Doncaster.
I never, ever once got the train home from doing that slot on talk radio without believing that I was going to be fired the next day. I would sit on that train with a can of lager and I would think to myself, right, what have you done wrong today? And I would tick them off. I would go, well, you shouldn't have said that. You crossed the line there. Somebody's going to be able to complain about you as a result of that. There are those people in the building who want you fired. There are those people at the radio authority who might have views about you. The interesting thing was the journalists liked it. I had very little negative copy. In fact, Stephen Armstrong, a critic then for Mail on Sunday, who now is an eminent arts critic with The Times and The Guardian, he wrote, Tommy Boyd presents the funniest show on British radio. And that's an accolade I took to my heart because previously the funniest show on the radio had been The Goons, Hancock, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. I wasn't in that league.
I'm trying to put myself in the position of being an enterprising burglar.
Okay.
And I want to rob your house.
Yep.
And you've got a monitored system.
Right.
And I walk up to it, cut the telephone line, and in I go, and nobody knows.
Well, you go right ahead and do that, and you will be in strange ways in about 20 minutes. I'll tell you why, because all of these monitoring systems alert the monitoring headquarters as soon as the wire is cut.
As soon as the wire is cut?
Yeah.
Well, there's the flaw in my argument, Tommy.
Yeah, I hope you're glad I told you that, Burglar Bill.
Yeah, OK, Tommy.
I had a programme director called John Simons at Talk Radio who was brilliant. He got it. And he used to encourage me to do a slot on a Friday afternoon called The Wonderful Hour. And his thinking was purely tactical. Because so much of what I did was appeared to be so toxic, even if it was also funny, he felt that I could rescue it if I did something that was completely and utterly endearing. So I came up with The Wonderful Hour, in which I would list a few things in my monologue that were wonderful. You know, the obvious ones, freshly baked bread and freshly mown grass, other little things. And then people would ring in their droves just to share things that they thought were wonderful. I remember a lorry driver ringing up and he said, "Hey, Tommy, I'll tell you what's wonderful, mate. I was in a shop and I was buying some food and there was a little old lady in front of me in the queue. And she only had some eggs and some bread and she dropped her money on the floor and it went everywhere. And she said, 'Oh dear, I must find every penny because that's all I've got to last me until pension day on Thursday.' And so we all got down on our hands and legs and she said, it's 97 pence it is, and I need every penny of the 97 pence. Anyway, we got all the money together, Tommy, and it came to over £5. And I'm sorry, mate, I've got to go because I'm filling up again." And I'm crying telling the story. But the following Monday, someone came on the air and said, "Sorry to be cynical," he said, "but maybe this was a scam that she was pulling up and down the country."
Tommy Boyd, he knows it all.
Catch him if you can, weekdays 4 till 7 on Talk Radio UK.
We just about cracked it in the afternoons, and the programme controller, Johnny Simons, did a presentation. He brought all the presenters in, and he showed everybody's listening figures in graphs. And I was enormously pleased and embarrassed because there was this huge spike in the afternoons. We were beating Radio 5. So I just about thought to myself, OK, I can get a two-year contract out of this, a rolling contract, because I can't stand these contracts with 3 months opt-out. That's just a three-month contract, man. So I was negotiating a two-year rolling contract. Then suddenly everyone had long faces, and that was because the station was going to be sold. Kelvin McKenzie was buying it, and he was going to fire everybody, was what we heard, and indeed pretty much what took place. 3 days after McKenzie arrived in the building, having fired all the management, I went in to see him because I wanted to say to him, just check the figures because this works, what I'm doing. But he said to me with his serious face, he went, "Don't be rude to the listeners." And what I should have said to him was, "I'm not rude to the listeners. I'm actually very, very polite and supportive to the listeners. I'm rude to the callers because the listeners want me to be rude to the callers because the callers are stupid enough to think that the propositions I'm making are real." But I didn't want to offend him, so I didn't say that. And the following day I was called in to the acting programme controller and he He asked me the second most unusual question I've ever been asked at work, which is, do you like football? I realise now why he asked me if I like football, but he fired me nevertheless. And then I was into legal disputes with them about my contract, because I did have a 2-year rolling contract, so they owed me 18 months worth of money. But I didn't need to go down the legal route, because I got a phone call from John Simons, who'd just been made programme controller of LBC. And he said, come across, what slot do you want? I'd like you to do afternoons. And I said, oh, give me breakfast. I said, because I used to produce it. And the idea of having produced it for Bob Holness and Douglas Cameron and then presenting it with Anne Diamond, it tickled me. But John got fired after 3 months for a stunt in which he pretended to be a caller. I don't know if... Oh, yeah, John doesn't care. He pretended to be a caller complaining about my show, who had a heart attack and died on the air. So I saw out my six-month contract and went back to TalkSport.
No, and repeating yourself isn't interesting.
No, I just said to you that I wasn't repeating myself, Tommy.
Can you lift it? Look, your problem is you're boring.
Yeah, I know I'm boring.
Well, then go away and bore another radio station.
At TalkSport, there was now a man in charge who I almost fell in love with. He's such a great person, figure, called Bill Ridley. Everyone loves Bill. And Bill said to me, oh, Tommy, so we've got to get you everywhere on the station. We've got to get you on breakfast or mid-morning or mid-afternoon. And he came up with this format where I was, right across the station, from having been fired for being appalling. Now I was the flavour of the month, year. He managed to put together a Friday, Saturday, Sunday night slot for me, where I had to come up with new formats yet again. And I came up with talking about wrestling in the evening on a Saturday, which proved to be ludicrously successful. We were getting more phone calls about wrestling than the football phoning which preceded it, which irked and confused a lot of traditionally minded people. And on a Sunday night, I came up with a format which ended up being called the Human Zoo, which was where we let the phone operators have the night off and calls would come to air unscreened. And the reason I came up with that idea was because in order to find out what the experience was like for a caller, I used to phone in shows. And I found myself getting nervous. Nervous of having to explain to a phone screener what I wanted to talk about. And then nervous not knowing when I was going to be on. And I honestly found my pulse rate going up. So I came up with this idea of just letting the calls come. And if they said, you know, a swear word, I'd dump them and that wouldn't be a problem. They never did. And after about 6 weeks, I found out that we were averaging, I think it was 36,000 calls an hour, which is a lot. And so the head of finance decided to make money out of that. So he metered them and he bought into a piece of software, which meant that everybody who phoned the station would be put on hold and they'd all be paying 90 pence a minute for the privilege. Well, that didn't work because people stopped calling. But the format still works and there are still people trying it. You know, my friend Ian Lee at the new talk radio occasionally tries it.
Let's go to line one. Good morning, you're live on Talk Sport. Hello there.
Hello.
Hello, who's this?
And then I allowed microphone to stay on when a caller called on the night that the Queen Mother died. And I was busy checking my emails and a caller came on and said I would like to pay tribute to Her Majesty. So I thought, oh, this is safe as houses. So I switched off and I started going through my emails. And then I became aware that the voice had changed in its timbre. And I thought, he said something he shouldn't have done. But I didn't know what it was. So I said something like, I cut you off. I didn't exactly catch what you said, but I don't agree with it. But I suppose you have the right to say what you say. And I got a phone call about a week later from Bill Ridley. Bill has a sacking voice. He's normally very avuncular, but when he's sacking you, it sounds like this. We have located the audio in question. A caller said that the royal family should be put up against a wall and shot. Your response was that he was entitled to that view. I'm afraid we're going to have to let you go. And so I went.
Tommy Boyd on BBC Southern Counties Radio.
And then the phone rang, and it was BBC Southern Counties Radio saying, what are you doing? And so I did a couple of years flitting between Brighton and Guildford, which were their two bases at the time, back at what was a much bigger version of BBC Radio Brighton, because it covered much of the south of England. But again, there were factions. I wanted to do the shows just from Brighton, and I was told I couldn't do that because for political reasons, I had to do three shows from Guildford and two shows from Brighton, which was very bitty because it meant I had different production teams, there was a different environment, the desks were slightly different. And then again, I found out there were factions within the building. You see, some things are baked into the brickwork, and you can come back to a radio station 30 years, 40 years later, and certain things are still going on. The big difference I found between Radio Brighton back in the 1970s and Southern Counties, which was BBC Radio Brighton much bigger in the 1990s, was that there was a new set of factions, which was married couples. And that was very prevalent at Southern Counties. So again, just as at Radio Brighton, you had to find your factions, at Southern County, you had to find your factions, because they didn't have to worry too much about audiences. They would get their £2.5 million of BBC licence money to carry on broadcasting pretty much whatever they did, as long as it looked as though it was of use to the community. And I didn't fit in too well because I wanted to do something that would fit into any community anywhere. I wasn't particularly interested if there had been a faulty iron started a fire in a house in Red Hill.
0845 957 0057 is the phone-in number. It's BBC Southern Counties Radio. I must say, this is a very...
By the time I left Southern Counties, I'd realised that I didn't want to have to do all the travelling that I was doing. So I found out that there was a company making internet radio that was only about 10 or 15 minutes by car from where I lived, and I went to work for them. And that was a company called Play Radio. And I had about 6 months of very enjoyable work there, building towards doing a proper talk radio station where we would be able to do the things that American talk radio does. Being internet, it was subject only to the law of the land. Pretty benign and foggy back then.
Now, live from the south coast of England, The Tommy Boyd Show, only on Play 2 UK.
But between now and 10 o'clock, it's Global News Talk with myself, Tommy Boyd.
And that job dried up. I got approached by a company in Southampton, which is close enough to where I lived, to do a show for a station called Original. And I took that on the basis that if they're called Original, they must want me to do something original. So again, I'm going to have a chance to be funny. But in actual fact, it was another commercial radio station playing. They wanted to play three hits in a row and then Traffic and Travel. And that took me up to a few years ago when I realised that if I was prepared to settle for drinking box wine, I didn't have to work again. And so I kind of stopped. And then I got a phone call out of the blue. And he said, my name's Denny Morris. You won't remember me. But when I was a kid, I was so keen on getting into radio, I kept bothering you for advice. And one day I said, can I come and see you at your home? And I spent all day in your house talking about radio. And you made me lunch. And I had a wonderful day. And I said, yeah, OK, where's all this going? He said, well, I'm now the programme controller of Talk Radio. The reason I'm ringing is because I think you're kind of okay and I'd like to offer you some work. That appealed to me enormously. So at this moment of talking out loud, that's what I do. Bits and pieces with Talk Radio and love it. Absolutely love it.
We thought that there are as many women's loos as there are men's loos, but that women take about five times as long as men.
And I've enjoyed bits and pieces of everywhere I've been because there's always some people who are immensely rewarding to work with. You just have to go around the workplace and find them and make friends with them. You influence the people you work with far more than the people who listen to your work. You've come and gone in their life outside of the show that you're doing. Whereas with your colleagues, you're with them for 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. You can get to care about the difficulties that they're having. You can support them in that. Where was I happiest? Possibly whenever and wherever I felt that I was being of use to colleagues who I was treating as friends. The unhappy bits of my broadcasting, I suppose, are connected to the fact that somebody once told me I was the most fired man in British radio. And that always was a problem because I have a wife and children to support and a mortgage to pay, and putting bread on the table was always a concern. I never felt as though I had enough money to be off for a year, which is always a danger if you're going to be fired. So the unhappy times really were when I sensed that I was going to be fired again. It never damaged what I did on air, I don't think, because, as I said, the red light is such a potent drug that it eases all fears, because it's now just you and the audience. So you don't worry too much about the daft boss who's just come in who wants to sweep clean, or the new programme controller who thinks that because you make it look effortless, it must be. And he knows a kid down at the local Tesco stacking the shelves who's got a great personality, so let's give him Tommy Boyd's slot. That's happened.
That is why you got the sack.
I hope to God I did.
That's why you got the sack from the other radio station.
Right from the off, I think my back was put up against people who don't broadcast but are in positions of authority over broadcasters, because way back at Radio Brighton, there was a station manager who would stop people on the stairs and tell them anything negative he could think about, saying to do with what they were wearing or something that they'd done on the radio. Oh, I didn't like that, mate. Can you not do that again? If you're expecting negative comments from management, it can tarnish what you're doing on the radio, and you have to somehow get them out of your head. I worked for one guy at Talk Radio who made sure everybody knew that he had a small transistor radio on his desk and it was tuned to Talk Radio all day long, and he would hear everything that everybody was doing. And one day he grabbed me and pulled me in and said, your language. He said, did you say bleeding? I said, well, no, I said something like bleeding, but I think I said bleeding, which I said you will hear at this moment in time, that is colloquially a marginally acceptable what once was a swear word, I said, and you have to do it sometimes in order to be as entertaining as possible. And he said, well, I'm going to ban it. So I said, okay. I said, could you do me a list of all the words that are banned? And I was genuinely interested in reading the list. I said, there must be about 90 of them, and then we'll know where we stand. And he never did. Of course, he couldn't. It's impossible. If it was a seesaw, I would say 99% of the things that I've heard are, don't do that. Can you not do this? That doesn't work. But every so often, a station manager will say, that was good. Can you do more of that? I worked for one programme controller called Jason Bryant at Talk Radio, and I wasn't sure whether Jason got it or not. And I used to go and see him every so often, sometimes every day, just to make sure that he was happy before I went on air. And I remember 3 or 4 days into this, Jason just looked at me and he said, Bridges, we're messing with God's plan. And I thought, he gets it. And I did it. I did it that afternoon. I said, we shouldn't build bridges. God put reasons and valleys on this planet for a reason, to separate us, to keep us apart, to keep warring factions from apart. We build bridges, we build tunnels. What are we doing? But the main thing was, I knew I was working for someone in management who was on my side, who got it. And that enabled me to, I think, perform better and come up with even better ideas. When you know that a programme controller or a station manager doesn't get it, well, you feel as though you're standing on that trapdoor. Being on air cures everything, except, obviously, you know, serious terminal diseases. You can feel depressed and the red light comes up and you feel fine. You can have a cold, but when the red light comes on, you've got to talk until 12 minutes past the hour. So what you have when you're broadcasting is order, and that's what we all seek in life, and the lack of it is what causes most of us to be sad a lot of the time. One of my heroes in broadcasting is Steve Wright, because that man must have the most fantastic iron resolve to do such a fantastic show as he does every day, and then repeat it the following day, and then repeat it the following day. I couldn't do that for about 10 days without climbing the walls. And in many ways, he's the best broadcaster we've got at the moment, in my view. If there are people who think that they might want to try and do things that they've heard me do, a piece of me wants to say to them, you really shouldn't do that, because I bet you've got much more to offer. If you explore yourself and find out what it is that's true about you that other people would benefit from hearing, because it's possibly true about them. And I've only just stumbled on it in the last few seconds, that over the last 40 years, without quite knowing it, that's possibly what has motivated me. So if having this opportunity to talk about myself and what I've done has been of no benefit to the listener, it's been quite beneficial to me. And I would think that if I was in therapy, and I have had my moments, I think this 45 minutes or 50 minutes would probably have cost me about 360.